Good evening, everyone. I must say, I'm getting very attached to this place. I'm supposed to leave tomorrow. It's been wonderful being here. And our topic for tonight is actually a topic that's very, very close to my heart. I teach Moser Vadim in Yerushalayim, in Beit Shemesh, and remotely over Zoom. And I always feel that the reason why women come to learn Torah, in addition to obviously connecting to Hashem's word, is to find anchors in their lives for difficult situations, to find relevance that relate to their personal growth. And really, my teaching, I always try to think of a way to connect with things that are on my mind. As somebody once said to me when I gave an idea over this, she said to me, "Do you live in my house?" So I said, no, I live in my house, and all of our houses are similar. And I think that that's really, really the case. So when the war broke out on October 7th, and it was Simchas Torah, and I started up my classes right after Yontif, I just couldn't move on to any topic other than what was going on with Klal Yisrael. And all the midos and topics that I did over the next 2 years all somehow related to the war on different levels. And specifically, the crisis of the hostages was something that really went into my heart very deeply as a mother of children. I just could not imagine what kind of... There's no words to describe what these people went through, the actual hostages themselves and their families and their siblings. And it was something that was very, very close to my heart. In fact, I have a friend, a good friend, who is a neuropsychologist and a big tzaddikus. And she did a lot of pro bono work with families of hostages. And, you know, Israel is now processing so much trauma. Chayalim coming back safely, but having experienced so many near-death experiences and just so many layers to the trauma work, and there's so much left to be done. And she used to tell me every so often, you know, we used to talk a little bit about different families and how they were coping, and those names of the people we were davening for became really alive to me. Knowing a little bit about them and which ones had siblings and the siblings who weren't sleeping at night because they didn't know where their brother was. And it just goes on and on. So this was very, very close to my heart. And most of the material that I was doing over 2 years really related on some level to the war. And then, in midst of that time period, my daughter was dating very seriously. She subsequently got engaged and got married. But over Pesach last year, I heard a certain vort by none other than Joey Newcomb, actually, this idea. And since I've been trying to find the actual Hasidic source for this, and I've not been able to find it, but when I heard this idea, it really moved me. And I said to myself, oh, I think that my future son-in-law would really appreciate this idea. And I really wanted to tell it over to him. And then I said to myself, you know, the poor guy is about to get a shviger. He doesn't also have to get a Moser Rabbitson, giving him Moser Vartz. So just like ask him what kind of coffee he likes and don't give him the Vartz. He got up at the engagement party after they got engaged and gave over this exact Dvar Torah that I thought he would like. So I guess I was right about that. And the truth is he said it much more eloquently than I could have said it. But I want to share it with you because it really relates to our topic tonight. We know that Chazal say that shidduchim are kasha kekriyas yamsof. The same lashon is also used about parnasa, that these are difficult like the splitting of the sea. So the question that emerges is, well, Hashem is kol yachol, Hashem is omnipotent, so how could we say that anything is hard for Hashem? So in order to understand and answer this question, we look at a source where Hashem himself says that something is difficult for him. And interestingly enough, the source is said in reference to Shmini Atzeres, which is the time that the whole unraveling of the unfortunate, difficult times that Klal Yisrael have been going through. So Hashem says, after we've spent the moed with him and we've been so close to him, Hashem says, Kasha alai predaschem. It's hard for me when you leave me. And therefore, the word kasha becomes not that something is technically difficult for Hashem, but rather that kivyachol, it's emotionally difficult for Hashem. So if we read that back into the first sources about the kasha, we come up with a very beautiful idea. A person develops a very close relationship with Hashem when he has a need, a strong need, something so basic like a shidduch or parnasa, and he davens and asks Hashem, and there's a very close relationship that's formed over this request. So this puts Hashem, kivyachol, in a quandary. He loves you very much, and he wants to give you the thing that you're asking for. But he's afraid that once he delivers, you won't be as close to him anymore. So, kasha lei predaschem. I want to deliver, but I also want the closeness to you. So my son-in-law says, so what's our answer to Hashem? Our answer is, don't worry. If I receive the thing that I'm asking for with such intensity, I'll never forget it. I'll remain close to you, Hashem, and the closeness will not be around the desperation, it will be around the gratitude. And that's really our answer to the Ribono Shel Olam. So later, I was discussing it with him, I said, like, the visual I have in my mind is that you move your request from your Shema Koleinu and your Rifa'inu to your Modim Anachnu Lach. And I had a very good teacher in third grade, because I remember everything she taught so many years later. Well, not everything, but at least this idea. She told us when she was teaching in Shmona Esrei, she said, your Shmona Esrei, your modim should always be more emotional than your Rifa'enu and your Shema Koleinu. To thank Hashem for the goodness in your life, that should move you very, very much. And I was thinking about this. This was in the midst of the war that all this was unraveling. And I developed a concept called the day after. In fact, my dear friend and student, Leah Hirschman, who writes so beautifully, just started a series on this in Bina magazine called The Day After. And the day after represents what will my life look like when Hashem delivers the thing that I've been asking for so much. And to be able to prepare for that, because it's easy to say, oh, I'll remain close, I'll remain connected. But we know that there's something about, you know, when finally you get the thing that you've been waiting for, you're excited for a while, and then it kind of fades into the woodworks of your life and it becomes regular. So if we want to prove to Hashem that it's not kasha lei predaschem, we have to think carefully what life is going to look like after Hashem delivers. So I call this concept the day after. I woke up on Hoshana Rabbah morning, and I couldn't believe it. Originally, when the war first broke out, I was asked to give a chizuk shir for my Mechala students over Zoom, and things were very hectic. I logged on just as Rav Rudman, a different teacher in Mechala, was finishing off his chizuk, and I only heard the last words that he said. And he said the words, Leman yechatzun yedidecha. So that your loved ones should be evacuated, should be saved. And this was around 4 days into the war. For the next 733 days, every time I said the words, Leman yechatzun yedidecha, I had in mind the list of all the names of the hostages with their ages. And I woke up on Hoshana Rabbah morning to a message from the Rudmans, and it just had three words. It said, Leman yechatzun yedidecha, where they're finally coming home. And it was, here we are, the day after. And I said, okay, this is where we have to put into practice this concept. I want to say one thing that often comes to mind is that when you can say yes, the struggle, the difficulty, the hostage crisis is over. But very often, we say yes, but. Yes, but the rehabilitation is going to be so complicated. Yes, but there are those who didn't come home. Yes, but there are still chayalim in danger in Gaza. And really, the problem is that if we wait to appreciate till everything is perfect in our lives, we will wait a long time. So the day after requires us saying yes and. Yes, there are still difficulties. There's still a lot to daven for in Rifa'enu and Shema Koleinu. But our mode of Menachelach has to be very, very emotional. And when we talk about the day after, it's not just true on a national level, it's true on a personal level. We have struggles in our lives, but we have to appreciate the breakthroughs when they happen. And that's really what I'd like to share with you. So I started realizing that saying that I will, you know, be as passionate, like, you know, the words in my davening changed from L'man Yechatzun Yidecha to L'man Yechatzun Yidecha with like three exclamation points. It happened. A tremendous nace. These people, after 737 days of torture, on their own 2 feet, they walk back to their families. It's beyond. But I realized that in my tefillah, at some point, as much as I want to anchor it permanently in my modim, it's not going to be as intense over time. And then, this is really what I want to talk about today. I started realizing if I want a permanent sign, something that I daven for, and many of us daven for 2 years straight, we want to be able to really live with the miracles. So when I got back to my classes this year after Sukkot, I said, after 2 years of learning about it, let's do a little bit of time of internalizing the messages learned from the war. And what we did every single week from post-Sukkot till now when I came for this trip was that every week we took one angle, one aspect of something that happened with one of the hostages or a piece of the story. And we try to find a take-home message that we can live with for a long term and as being the ultimate way to really continue to celebrate the day after. I must say that I was looking for a title for the series, and somebody said to me, why don't you call it Take-Homes from the Homecomings? I didn't call it that, because I have a woman in one of my classes in Beit Shemesh who lost a son in Gaza. And I didn't think I could say homecomings because not everybody came home. But the fact that we have to learn from Hashem's Nisim and apply them to our lives is something that I feel is very important. We have a source for this in Nazir Beis. The Gemara tells us about the smichus parshios between Nazir and Sota. Kol haro'es Sota b'kilkulah yazir atzmo min hayayin. It's a conceptual Sota and a conceptual Nazir. They didn't actually see each other, but in the Torah, they're in the same neighborhood. They're right next to each other. And the Torah tells us that the Nazir hears about the Sota. He decides not to drink wine. The Baal Shem Tov says about this, a very important lesson is learned. There is a hashkacha in what you're exposed to and what you see and what you hear about. And sometimes if we hear about a scandal like the Isha Sota, we roll our eyes and say, oh, what is this crazy world coming to? And we just feel very much like a tzaddik and we didn't do anything other than roll our eyes. Baal Shem Tov says that the Gemara is teaching you to say, if I saw something, heard about something, experienced something, how am I going to grow from it? The Nazir doesn't roll his eyes. He says, how can I grow from this sugya called the Isha Sota? And even though he's an upstanding moral person, he comes to the conclusion that maybe he shouldn't drink wine because when a person is drunk, They can't have full control over their conduct. So that was his personal take-home message. And you can come to different messages. But the Baal Shem Tov says what you learn is that we have to take experiences that are outside of us, and when they move us, we should take home a message that affects our lives. So if this is true about negative things, like a scandal, Kal v'chomer, it's true about nisim and beautiful things that happen. What is the take-home message for us? So I want to share with you a few of the ideas, and there's a lot of them. I hope I'll be choosing the right ones. So the first thing that we discussed is the fact that the hostage crisis ended 2 years to the day. And that's, what are the chances of that happening? 1 in 365. So clearly Hashem is giving us a message with that. And in Parshas Miketz, we have a young man who is also in captivity. And the Parsha tells us, V'hi Miketz Natayim Yamim, that 2 years to the day is when Yosef, a Goyish king, comes to him and says to him, V'yaritzu min abar. They shaved him, they dressed him, and he left. And Trump comes to the hostages and says, out, time to go. And they get shaved and dressed, and they leave. So the Medrash in Bereishis Rabba says, why does it say Miketz? It could have said Kechlot Shnatayim Yamim or Achrei Shnatayim Yamim. Why Miketz? The Medrash says that the word Miketz is supposed to remind you of the Pasuk in Iyov Kaf Ches. Ketz Sam L'choshech. Hashem puts an end to darkness. And what we learn from the fact that Hashem closed up this crisis exactly 2 years, exactly, is for you to know that He puts an end to suffering. Rabbi Yerucham Lubavitch, the Mashgiach of the Mir, says that His goodness is infinite, but bad things have an end. And Hashem packaged it up at a 2 year mark for you to have a visual that your personal struggles come to an end as well. And that everything is carefully meted out, and there isn't an extra day. It doesn't have to be. There's much more to say on the topic of Yosef, but I really want to cover a few different points. I will just say that when I heard this idea about the 2 years with Yosef or the 2 years with the hostages, it got me looking through the whole sugya of Yosef, and I found around 10 parallels between our hostage crisis and the story of Yosef. And you just see how history repeats itself. And Baruch Hashem is giving you hints to what happened in our times in the story of Yosef. Maybe I'll get to some of them. Some of them are really actually very fascinating. But I want to share with you a main idea that really moved me. We see, as the stories of the hostages are unraveling, we see a very strong connection between things that the parents were doing and the things that their children in captivity were doing. So powerful that even if you have a hard time connecting to metaphysical ideas, it's very hard to deny the metaphysical connection here. The one that most comes to mind is Omer Shem Tov, whose mother Shelley decided to say Perek Chaf of Tehillim as a schus that her son should come home safely from captivity. When Omer was released, he was shocked to find out that his mother was saying Perek Chaf, because the Arab captors had found Hebrew writing in Gaza left behind by soldiers, and they forced him to translate because they wanted to make sure that it wasn't military material. It wasn't. It was things from the Torah and different tefillos. And Omer got to keep some of those things. And one of them was a piece of Tefillas HaDerech on one side and Perek Chaf of Tehillim on the other side. And he started saying Perek Chaf every day. What were the chances? 1 in 150. I will tell you that hearing Omer talk about the hundreds of miracles, I spoke in Brewery High School in Elizabeth, New Jersey last Friday, and they told me when I came that the pressure's on because our last speaker last week was Omer Shem Tov. I'm like, okay, hard act to follow. Very inspiring to hear what these people have to say. Another one of the hostages, Segev Kalfon, came out of captivity. And his father, most of these families were not religious, maybe a little traditional, but they connected to religious things. So his father had developed a connection with the Yanuka, a certain Mekubal, young Mekubal in Eretz Yisrael, who told him that as a schos for his son's return, he should learn the parsha of Yaakov and Yosef. In the Torah, the reunification of a father and son after many years in captivity. So he started doing that. Segev was shocked to hear what his father was doing, because when he was in captivity, his captors were bothered that he didn't know the stories of Tanakh. They decided to teach him, and they taught him the story of Yaakov and Yosef in Arabic, animated. And he starts telling the story. Yeah, Yosef went through a lot of things, and he had a lot of strength, and he overcame trouble. Like, these two people were doing the same thing without knowing. Sasha Tropanov was a Russian, not religious, hostage whose mother didn't have a Jewish name. And as part of her spiritual journey while her son was in captivity, she decided to take a Jewish name for herself, and she called herself Rachel, because Rachel Mevakal Baneha, and her only son, was in captivity in Gaza. Her son, Sasha, in captivity, was asked to choose an Arabic name for himself. He didn't want to call himself Muhammad or anything like that, so he chose the name Yusuf because it was close to Yosef. And he comes out of captivity, mother and son, Rachel and Yosef, both chose the names with obviously no connection to each other. All the connections here were all metaphysical. And I want to tell you what I think the take-home message is for us. I think that the idea of us being able to influence our loved ones metaphysically is a theme that comes out from these stories. And I want to share with you why I think it's important for us, because sometimes there's somebody in our life who we're very concerned about. We try to influence them directly, and we're not successful. So we kind of feel like very dejected that we care about somebody and we have no influence. And what we learn from Segev and from Omer and from Sasha is that loved ones have a lot of influence on each other on a metaphysical level. And now I'll share with you a less known story. These stories are publicized, and maybe some of you have heard them just like I heard them. But when my friend, the neuropsychologist, would share with me a little bit about the family, she told me about a certain mother who she asked me to reach out to this mother and develop a little bit of a connection with her. Tammy Breslovsky is the mother of Rome Breslovsky, who was one of the hostages who was tortured very, very badly by the Islamic Jihad. And the mother, who didn't even know what her son was going through, she had wanted to come to America. I was going on a speaking tour this summer, and we made a ticket for her to come with me and to speak about Rome while being in America. As it ends up, it wasn't possible for her to travel. What different siblings and families were going through was very, very difficult over the past 2 years. But she told me Rome's story, and she told me to share Rome's story. And I want to, this was before he came out, so this is back then. She told me the hardest thing for her was being a mother who could not do anything to help her child. It was devastating. She says to me, "Ani lo datia," but I started realizing that I have to advocate for my son with God, and I have to believe that I can influence the situation. So she said, I started davening, even though I wasn't a person who davened. And I would ask Hashem for all kinds of small things. And she said, one day, I said to Hashem, could you please take one of the captors, the evil terrorist who's holding my child, and let him do something a little bit out of character, something a little pleasant, something nice for my son, just to give him a little bit of hope. Shortly after that, Sasha, who came out of captivity way before Rome, and what the hostages used to do is that if they had interacted with any others in captivity, they tracked down the parents to say, eyewitness report, your child's alive. Now, Rome was held basically in solitary confinement for 2 years. But he overlapped with Sasha for 3 days. So Sasha went to track down Rome's mother, Tammy. And the first thing he said to her is, your son prays every day. The first thing he does in the morning is he prays. So she says, my Rome prays? What is he praying? And Sasha said, the truth is, I don't really know the prayers either, but he prays. And then he told her something, which was so important for her to hear. And it really relates to our topic. They were together for 3 days. And they had such minimal things that they owned. But one of the things that was very dear to them was that they had notebooks. And the notebooks were like very anchoring, that they would try to keep track of the dates and the Jewish calendar. And it was very important for them to have these notebooks. At one point, the notebooks were confiscated, and they were really devastated. Sasha said after 3 days together with Rome, they were separated. He said, the last thing I saw of your son, I was put in a car going to one destination. Your son was put in a car going to another destination. And as he was driving away from the terrorists who had kept him up till then, the last thing I saw was that the terrorists yelled out to the driver to stop driving. He ran over to the car and handed Rome back his notebook and shook his hand, shalom. She said, to tell you that that was out of character for this captor, I cannot tell you how out of character it was. And it's kind of strange that I saw that, but that's the last thing I saw. And Tommy said to me, I know exactly why he had to see that. If out of 2 years, there's only 3 days of eyewitness reports, and he saw that, that was to tell me that my tefillah were having an influence on my son. So what's the take-home message for us? The take-home message is that we have a tremendous amount of influence on our loved ones. And often, when we think we're influencing directly, we may not be, but our attempts in Ruchnias, the quiet ones, the ones that may, that the person, in all the cases that I'm talking about, the recipient, the child had no concept. There was no connection. And yet there's clearly a very strong connection because there's no way to explain all these coincidences. It gives us koach to understand that we have a tremendous amount of influence on people that we care about. And I want to connect this to one of my favorite sources in Chazal, and then I'll go back to a few more examples from the war. There's a Chazal in Kiddushin Mem, where Chazal say, Machshava Tova, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mitzarfa L'Maaseh. I find this source to be a tremendous source of chizuk. The way we always understand that Gemara is that good thoughts are counted as actions. If you wanted to go be Menachem Avel by somebody, you couldn't make it, you wanted to give tzedakah, you didn't have change, Hashem counts it as an action. That's the way we usually understand this concept. But the Ma'or Einayim, the Chernobyl Rebbe, in his Perush on this Chazal, says that the words don't make sense. Machshava Tova, good intentions, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mitzarfa L'masa, Hashem combines it to an action. Not that he counts it as an action, but he combines it to an action, with an action. What does that mean? So before I give you the Ma'or Einayim's Perush, I have to share with you a funny story that happened to me that really connects to this. I was once giving a shir somewhere in New Jersey, And I was going up to the podium, and somebody slipped out of the audience, and she whispered something to me, one sentence, and then she slipped back into the audience. And she said to me, "Mrs. Schoolmaker, I want to tell you that when you get up to Shamayim, there'll be a surprise waiting for you there." And then she slipped back into the audience. Now, Baruch Hashem, she said it with a smile, because I think if she wouldn't have said it with a smile, I would have been shaking. Now, I have to tell you that speakers can multitask. They can give a shiur and say, "What was that? What was that? What was that?" By the end of the shiur, I figured out what it was. This girl had been a student of mine in Mechala many years earlier. She was now married with a family. But I think what she meant was that at the time, when she was 18, I have times that my students sign up to be able to discuss anything that's on their mind. She came to me once about a personal struggle that she had, and she asked me for advice. I gave her advice, and she didn't like that advice very much. And she never followed up with me, and we never had any contact after that. This was her many years later. And she was telling me, "You think you didn't do anything for me, but when you get to Shemayim, there'll be a surprise waiting for you there." Now I'll explain to you the Maor HaNaim. Maor HaNaim says, "Machshava tova, good intentions, are matzmiach ma'aseh, they cause an action to grow. Somebody else does the action, but you had the intention. Hashem takes your machshava tova, your good intentions, and he's mitzarfa lema'aseh, he combines it to somebody else's action that happened because of you. They go up to Shemayim together, and both parties get schar." Meaning, you weren't the hero who actually did the good, the you know, whatever it was, the chesed or the advice or whatever, but you're the anonymous donor because your good intentions caused that action to happen. And that's the way he explains this Gemara. I find this to be very, very important for us as Jewish women. We have people who we care about. We have people who we wish we could help. And sometimes as close as you are to the person, you might not be the right shaliach. And you've tried, but the person doesn't want to hear from you. And you kind of feel a little helpless, like there's nothing I could do, and it bothers me so much. This concept teaches you that your ratzon, your machshava tova, causes somebody else to be the shaliach. And the action gets done. It's the metaphysical influence we have on people we care about. And my favorite war story, which really proves this point, is, I'm sorry, there are people here who heard me say this already. I apologize. But I always tell this story that there was, around 3 weeks into the war, there was a message that was going around Israel. If you remember, there were over 200 hostages in the beginning, and many of them were children. And there was a message that was circulating in Israel that a little 8-year-old boy, Ohad Mandor, is about to have a birthday in captivity. Click here to send a birthday message to Ohad. Wish Ohad a happy birthday. Now, I'm not usually cynical, but I was kind of wondering, where exactly am I clicking to send this birthday message? I mean, this boy is a captive. Nobody knows where he is. And where am I sending this message? I'm sending it to cyberspace. Where is this message going? And then I learned my lesson. Because around 50 days into the crisis, when the children were released, Ohad told somebody a very incredible story. He said that his first few weeks in captivity, he was being held by himself. Imagine an 8-year-old boy all by himself. And then the location of the hostages were switched, as they were often. And then all of a sudden, there was somebody put together with him. He had never seen this person before, another hostage. He had never seen him before. But that hostage looked at the little boy and said to him, "You're Ohad. Happy birthday to you." And he says to this man, "How do you know me? And how do you know it was my birthday? So he says, well, I was being held in captivity by terrorists who were soccer fans, and they used to watch soccer games on TV. So I was shackled in the corner of the room, and they were watching a ball game. And all of a sudden, in the middle of the ball game, one of the players stopped and said, I'd like a moment of silence to say happy birthday to a little boy in Gaza. And then he picked up a picture of you. And now I'm with you. So happy birthday, all. The little boy said that for the first few weeks in captivity until this happened, he never allowed himself to cry because he thought that nobody was looking for him, that everybody thought he was dead, and that he was going to be stuck for the rest of his life dead because nobody was going to look for him. And then he got the chizuk that let him continue and have koach till the end, till he got released 50-something days into the crisis. When I heard the story, it's unbelievable, and I said to myself, Machshava Tova, you're clicking happy birthday into cyberspace. And Hashem sends his shlichim, interesting ones, soccer players, but the message gets across. And the chizuk for us is that we should, Hashem has very creative ways. And just on a lighter level, how many times does a child of yours come home and says, my friend's mother told me something awesome, or my Rebbe just said something, and you're thinking like, yeah, I've been trying to tell you that for the past 15 years. Sometimes they have to hear it from somebody else. And you're not the hero. But you're the anonymous donor. And your ratzon caused it to happen. Okay. So I think that this is a very important take home from the war. Something that we have to think about, which is how do we have metaphysical influence on our loved ones? It could be a tefillah, it could be a bracha, it could be that if you're worried about someone's shalom bayis and you work on your own shalom bayis, it's things that we do, we're not even modeling, we're influencing from far. And Stephen Covey, in his book, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, he says, effective people have a maximal overlap between their circle of influence and their circle of concern. Meaning they don't think about things that they can't influence. So you don't worry about things unless you have a solution for them. And that's what effective people do. They worry about things that they can influence. The circle of concern, circle of influence, one has a major overlap, that's an effective person. People who worry about problems they can't solve are not being effective. Stephen Covey was a Mormon. And most of that book, the book is given out by the Miriam Ashkichim to Bachram to read. It's a very Jewishly oriented book. But that piece is not Jewish. Because we just learned that Jews can influence everything. With your machshava, with your tefillah, with your ratzon, there's nothing that's not in your influence of concern. And therefore you could be concerned about it because you can influence it. Okay. I want to go to another theme. And there's so many different pieces, but we don't have that much time. When I started doing the research, and I looked at the story of Yosef HaTzadik, and there are so many parallels that are basic, obvious. Yosef was a young man when he was in captivity. He was taken by Yishmaelim. So where are, you know, hostages who are mostly young, taken by Yishmaelim? His location was changed many times, so was theirs. He didn't know when he was getting out, so were there. Many things. But then I came to one piece that was pretty shocking to me. There was a certain point in the war that was a very, very low point for many people when, you know, after Shabbos, we heard the news that there were three hostages who managed to escape from captivity and then got killed by friendly fire. And it was a terribly low point in Israel at that point. It was like very, 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 very heartbreaking. I came into Mechalah the next day and I had give a little bitachon lunchtime chabura. And I always tell the girls, when we learn bitachon, we have to apply it to whatever's going on in our lives. I walked into school and the girls looked like so sad. And they said, okay, you know, pressure's on, Mrs. Gomaker. You have to have something to tell us about this terrible tragedy and how we can have a hashkafa on it. And the truth is that when I had heard the story, what often happens when people are killed by friendly fire or when there's some kind of, you know, mistake like that that happens, is that often there are investigations afterwards to find out if they were irresponsible, if they could have done it differently. And I always think about the fact of how terrible is it that first you do something like this and then you're actually accused afterwards. It's like the loving parent who, chas v'shalom, the child gets into an accident or gets burnt, and then you get to the hospital and the social worker starts checking you for abuse. It's terrible. So what is the Torah Hashkafa? So I have to tell you first that before we say the Torah Hashkafa, just to show you how much it's amazing how things are hinted to in the Torah. In the Torah, Yosef was the captive, and Reuven, his brother, put him in a pit in order to save him from the brothers killing him. Reuven comes back to take Yosef out of the pit. And what does the Pasuk say? Bereishis Lamed Zayin Chavtes. Vayeshev Reuven el habor, v'hinei ein Yosef babor, v'ikrat begadav. He came to save his brother. That's what he came for, to save his brother. That was the whole plan, was to save him. He comes to save him, and Yosef isn't there anymore. Vayeshev el achav, vayomer, hayeled einenu, v'ani ana aniba. The child is no longer alive, and where am I going to go now? Lamech Davar says, Ani anani ba, where am I going to go? The eze makom eye gole kidin hahoreg b'shogeg. Where should I go? I killed my brother mistakenly. And I said to myself, it's unbelievable. This pasuk could have been said by these chayalim. They came to save the Yosefs. They came to save the captives. Vayelad einenu, v'ani anani ba. I came to save him. I killed him inadvertently. And where should I go now? So it's amazing to see how things, this is the Mekechna time, Yamim, the 2 years. And look what the Torah is hinting to. There are many other things. So what was the message to my students, and what can I share that we can integrate into our lives? The Gemara in Brachos Yud Zayin tells us what our attitude is supposed to be when something like this happens. The Torah Hashkafa is not investigations and not guilt for a person who does an action like that. The Gemara says, Kol ha'oseh davar echad u'mitbayesh mimeno mochlin lo al kol avonotav. When a person does an action that causes him deep shame, he is forgiven for all of his averus. The Shaar Tshuva brings down this chazal. And the Mefarshim ask, you know, it would be understood if a person does something and he regrets it, that he's forgiven for that specific action would make sense. But how can chazal say, mochlin lo al kol avonotav? Everything he's ever done wrong is forgiven? And the understanding we have is when a person does something that is so antithetical, so opposite of what he wanted to accomplish, that alone is so devastating, he doesn't need investigations, he doesn't need punishment. In fact, the Torah says the opposite. Mochlin al kol avonotav, a clean slate. Hashem knows how deeply you regret something, and he purifies you from that. So my students are so sweet. They say, oh, Mrs. Gomaker, can you go find those chayalim and share that source? So it doesn't exactly work that way. People's identities are covered. But I want to share this with us. On our own level, sometimes as mothers and as daughters and siblings, sometimes You wanted to do something good for somebody. And all you did was something out of love, and it backfired completely. You thought that that school was the best school for your kid. You thought he would thrive there. You pushed to get him in, and he had a terrible experience. You encouraged a certain friendship, and that friendship took your child to a bad place. You encouraged a certain method of solving a problem, and it totally backfired. And there's so much Jewish guilt. We feel, Vani anani ba, where am I going? I'm responsible for this problem. I'm responsible for the bad outcome. And what we learn is that that's not the way Hashem looks at it. Hashem knows that all you wanted to do is do something good. And the fact that it backfired, you're human. You tried. Maybe you even made a big mistake. But Hashem doesn't put you through investigations. Something very deep is going on here. Because when a person means to accomplish something good and it backfires, Hashem is in the world of machshava. And he understands that this is very, very difficult for you. So I think that the message that we see in the Torah, which is parallel to the story of the Chayalim, is parallel to our Jewish guilt. That sometimes all you wanted to do was do the right thing, and something didn't work out the way you planned. And medications that have terrible side effects, and summer camps where the child was bullied. So many things in our life where we pushed for something that we thought was good for the kid, and it ended up not being that way. And decisions we make for aging parents that don't work for them, the list goes on. But I think that the message here is not just a message for the specific situation, it's a message for all of us as how Hashem relates to these kinds of things. Okay, I'd like to mention maybe one last one. We can ask the question sometimes, how is it that these people were Zocha to a Nes? 737 days, they were near death countless times, and that they came back on 2 feet. And if you hear the evaluation of many psychologists, many of them have tremendous resilience. So we have 2 answers to that. One answer is the fact that many of them discovered Ruchnius when they were in captivity. The typical profile of the typical hostage was that they did not have a religious life before. Many of them did not believe in God. And they go into captivity, and suddenly they discovered God. When I try to be machazik my students about removing themselves a little bit from technology, I say, you know, these hostages were denied so many things. But the one good thing is that they didn't have access to any addictive substances. No alcohol, no drugs, no smartphone, no technology, no internet for 2 years. It was a major detox. And many of them say that they discovered very, very important things while they were in captivity. And the Torah tells us that Potiphar, the Rasha, realized that Yosef was connected to Hashem. Vayar Adonav ki elukav imo. And the Mepharshim say, the Potiphar HaRasha noticed. So Rashi says, because Shem Shemaim Shagor Befiv. Because Yosef was always talking to Hashem in captivity. And Potiphar the Rasha noticed. Many of the hostages say that they were respected for their desire for tefillah. Matan Angrest, who was a chayal, who was very badly tortured in captivity, said that when he asked for a sitter and a Tanakh, they gave it to him. And he structured his whole day. He was totally not religious. He came from a very secular home. He structured his whole day around Shacharis, Mincha, and Maariv, that he had never once davened before in his life. And learning Tanakh. So Shem Shemaim Shagur Befiv. People discovered Hashem in captivity. And there's a very interesting Gemara in Brachos Chas. Chazal say, Kol ha'osek b'Torah u'begmilut chasadim u'mitzpalel im hatzibor ma'ale ani alav ki'ilu pida'ani mi'ben umos ha'olam. Now, the Altar of Kiln talks specifically about tefillah, although it really talks about Torah and chesed and tefillah. Listen to the words. Very relevant to our situation. A person who davens, Hashem considers it ki'ilu pida'ani, as if you released me, Hashem, from captivity of the nations. Hashem is the hostage. And when you daven, you take him out of captivity. What does that mean? So the Altar of Kelm explains, Hashem is the ultimate mativ. He just wants to give to us, and he supports and loves 8 billion people and is giving to them always. And how many of them receive and realize that they're being nurtured by Hashem, by a loving God? Very, very few. People are either totally taking advantage of the fact that they live and breathe and have what they have, or else they may be thanking the wrong God. But when the Jewish people daven to Hashem, and they're mindful that everything they get is from Him, they release Hashem from captivity. So in order to understand this, I'll give a mashal. If I, as a mother, plan a Chol HaMoed trip, because I want to nurture my children and give them a good feeling and put a lot of effort into a lot of the details, and the family goes on the trip, and some of the kids fetch a lot because they weren't sitting near the window, and some of them just enjoy the day but don't say anything to me, and one child comes over to me at the end of the trip and says, Mommy, that was a beautiful day. Thank you so much for all the effort you put into all the details. That child redeemed me. Because I am not a party planner or a travel advisor. I'm a mother who wants to nurture her children. And when somebody realizes that what they received was coming from my desire to be loving and nurturing, they redeemed me. The Altar of Kelm says Hashem is shackled by the nations because he loves and gives, but nobody receives and appreciates. So when we, the Jewish people, thank him, we unshackle him. We take him out of captivity. And the interesting paradox is that these hostages, when they were in the captivity of the nations, they were releasing God from his captivity in the nations because they were discovering him for the first time and thanking him for the water, the bread, whatever it was they had. And I'll just end with the last point. A point that remains very painful in the situation in Israel, and there's quite a few aspects that are still unresolved and are difficult. But there's a lot of tension between different factions in Israel, specifically around the topic of the drafting of yeshiva boys. Tremendous tension. So a certain Haredi person connected to the government once said to me that the Anglo-From will be able to bridge the gap between all the different factions in Israel. So you have a job to actually try to bring peace and try to help people understand each other. Very, very difficult. So I'd like to do a little something to bridge the gap. There is a source that we say in Challah. We ask the question, Malacha Hayam Kitanos. In Kriyas Yam Suf, we say to the Yam, why did you agree to run away, to split? And Chazal tell us, Nas Mipnei Hanas, that the reason why Kriyat Yam Suf, where the water split, is because Bischus Atzvot Shel Yosef, because he ran away from the temptation of Eshet Potiphar. And the Pasuk says, Vayanas Vayetze Achutza. He overcame temptation. He ran away. Nas Mipnei Hanas. Because Yosef had run away, that's why the water agreed to run away. So what does this really mean? It really means that when a person goes against his nature, he is zoche, that Hashem changes nature for him. And here is the word that I like to say that bridges a little gap. Rav David Pivarsky, who was the Rosh Hashiva of Panovich, said, when I hear about a chayal, a soldier, who a bullet skin grazes his skin or goes around him, or the chayal who just gets out of a dangerous situation, he said, I know one thing about that young man, that somewhere in his life he overcame a big temptation and God changed nature for him. And I think that the message, besides the fact that it bridges a little gap, it also teaches us a lesson. There are times when we have struggles, whether they're health struggles or other struggles, where we need Hashem to change nature for us. We need something to change. And there's so many schools that people do, they run to different places in the world and they ask, it's all good, I'm not criticizing anything. But I say to myself, I don't know if I have to go to Meron or Karastir or anywhere, or if in my own living room of my own house, if I overcome my nature, I could be bringing a breaking of nature in a problem. I know for me and for many women, some of our breaking our nature has to do with speech. Sometimes we like to have the last word. Sometimes we like to put people in their place. Sometimes we criticize. Everybody has all kinds of things where they have to break their own nature. And nas b'fnei hanas, Hashem breaks the nature, changes nature for people who fight their own nature and overcome it. So it's a skula to bring protection into your life, to protect people who are in danger in all kinds of situations. This is what we can do. This is our ammunition to help people who are struggling. So to wrap up, I think that in the day after, we need to take messages. We need to look at miracles, look at events, and say, what's the take-home message? So to summarize the few we did today, Kate Sam Lachoshech, Hashem, at a two-year mark, was teaching you that there's an end to your struggle. The metaphysical effect that we have on our loved ones, the things that we're doing, where we're the anonymous donor. We're not the hero of the story, but our quiet desire to help causes somebody else to help. The fact that when we feel guilty, when we love somebody very much, but we do something which really backfires, we know that Hashem is rachamim and forgives us. The fact that shem shamayim shagur b'fiv, that when a person is always talking about Hashem, he also releases Hashem from captivity. And the fact that when we overcome our nature, we cause supernatural things to happen in our lives. So this is just a few, my own little 2 cents. You could probably come up with many, many more. But the overarching message is that when you experience a miracle, when something beautiful happens, whether it's in your personal life or in our national history, we want to conceptualize, we want to take a message, we want to apply it so that many years later we could say, that hostage crisis changed my attitude towards something, changed my behavior in some way, and this is how we show Hashem that we never forget when He gives us and gives us many nisim. Thank you very much.